Hello and welcome to this JAMA author interview. I'm Dr. Preeti Malani, JAMA Associate Editor. Today's interview is related to our July 28, 2015 theme issue, recognizing 50 years of Medicare and Medicaid. I'm delighted to have Dr. Drew Altman, President and CEO of the Kaiser Family Foundation, as well as Senator Bill Frist, the former U.S. Senate Majority Leader, join me today. Senator Frist is also Dr. Frist, a cardiothoracic surgeon. Both of our guests are well-known in U.S. health policy circles and the authors of a comprehensive review in this week's JAMA that summarizes Medicare and Medicaid at 50 years. The establishment of Medicare and Medicaid 50 years ago truly transformed health care in the United States. Currently, Medicare covers 55 million individuals and has annual costs of $585 million. Medicaid covers 66 million individuals and costs $449 million. Combined, these programs insure 111 million people, or one in three individuals in the United States. Beneficiaries, health professionals, and institutions, as well as policymakers, often have very different interests related to Medicare and Medicaid, which complicates efforts to change these programs. I'm going to ask our authors to comment on these various perspectives, and we'll also consider the future of these programs and some of the looming challenges. Let's begin with Dr. Altman. Can you summarize some of the current issues and challenges surrounding Medicare from the perspectives of beneficiaries and the public at large?
Well, first, thanks very much for having us. It's been my experience that you have almost entirely different conversations about Medicare and also Medicaid, depending on whether you're talking with health professionals and policymakers and politicians or beneficiaries. And we organized our paper exactly that way, looking at each program from the perspectives of each of the different groups. There's always a lot of discussion about Medicare. It's a sacrosanct program. It's a popular program. But it's also a program that will continue to face big policy challenges in the future. With spending slowing down, it's not clear how soon policymakers will return to really big ideas about the future of the program. But there are big questions that will remain on the table, including most especially whether Medicare should remain an open-ended entitlement program or whether the financial risks for the program should be capped for the future in some way. The idea of premium support is often discussed. How far the privatization of the program should go, it's a common challenge in both programs. What cost sharing should look like in each program. Their roles in payment and delivery reform, which are huge, especially for Medicare. There's an old expression, when Medicare sneezes, healthcare catches cold, which we used in the paper, and it's always been true. So we discuss all of these things in the paper.
Thank you, Dr. Altman. Now let's turn to Senator Frist to discuss Medicare from the perspective of healthcare professionals and healthcare institutions. Dr. Frist, your thoughts?
Well, I would add to really what Drew said from the perspective of the provider, the doctors, the nurses, the ancillary personnel, in that a huge challenge is the what we call the silver tsunami. And between 2010 and 2050, the number of Americans over 80 years is going to triple, and those over the age of 90 will quadruple. Over time, a smaller share of these retirees will have employer-sponsored retiree health benefits or the defined benefit pension plans that are out there. And then in addition, the health-conscious baby boomers may cross into this Medicare threshold and enjoy, yes, more years of good health than their predecessors, thank goodness. However, the gains in longevity are likely to lead to more people living longer with multiple chronic conditions, which in turn will have cost implications for families and Medicare alike. With half of today's Medicare beneficiaries in pretty good shape, relatively good shape from the provider standpoint, about 45% today have what we call four or more chronic conditions. It might be chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, it might be diabetes, it might be heart disease, it might be cancer. And 34% or one-third have a functional impairment, and about a third have a cognitive or mental impairment. So all of this increase in chronic disease that we're seeing today compared to 10 years ago, with people living longer and longer lives, from the provider standpoint, it becomes increasingly complex in managing these patients and also increasingly expensive because of the chronic diseases that they are taking care of. That will be the main difference that the provider sees, the whole issue of reimbursement of the changes that normally come in incrementally over time, like the drug coverage when I was majority leader added in 2006, the inclusion of private plans and Medicare Advantage. The natural evolution of the structure will continue over time as we address these challenges, but the population itself will become increasingly complex over the next 30 years.
Dr. Altman, do you have something to add to this?
Just to add to a point, a really important point Senator Frist made about who are Medicare beneficiaries. He talked about people with multiple chronic conditions, and he talked about the aging of the population. Our paper is full of numbers, and in all those numbers, there are some killer numbers. I mean just some very important numbers. One of them for Medicare is $23,500, and that's the median income of Medicare beneficiaries. So people may have this image of, they're called greedy geezers, Medicare beneficiaries playing golf, and bless them, some Medicare beneficiaries do very happily play golf, but most don't. Most have very modest income, they have very modest savings, $60,000 is the median amount for savings for a Medicare beneficiary. So at the end of the day, for Medicare, and it's true for Medicaid even more so, and we'll talk about that, we're talking about a very needy population that needs a lot of help. There's a lot of discussion in the country right now about equality and income security and equity. Seniors are also part of that discussion.
Now let's consider the perspective of policymakers and elected officials. So Dr. Frist, you served as the Senate Majority Leader. I imagine that Medicare was an issue that was constantly on your mind, perhaps maybe even more so as a physician turned lawmaker. Can you share some of your personal experiences and also offer some general comments on Medicare from the perspective of elected officials and policymakers?
The reason that Drew and I decided to address our audience from the public perspective and providers and policy, because the angles were all just a little bit different. So now I'll put on my hat, not as the physician, but that of the United States Senator and Majority Leader. In this course of Medicare over time, it's not a static program. We all know how it got implemented and begun in 1965 at a time that, you know, roughly 50% of seniors did not have health insurance. And with Medicare, then almost 100% had that health insurance. But throughout, there have been continual improvements and additional programs. For example, in 2006, it was clear to me as a majority leader of the Senate, but also as a physician who's taking care of thousands and thousands of patients, that in 2006, unlike in 1965, the medicines that we had are hugely powerful in terms of not just treatment of disease, but also for prevention. Yet Medicare did not cover prescription drugs before that period of time in 2003, that ultimately we passed the Medicare Modernization Act, where the addition of outpatient prescription drugs were a part of the Medicare program. So that's where the special attention with changing science that the policymaker needs to be kept in tune with and really soliciting information on science and state of the art. An important distinction should also, for our readers and those listening now, is between Medicare, and we'll come to Medicaid shortly, but Medicare, mainly seniors, mainly over the age of 65, there are 9 million others who are not over 65, but the overwhelming majority over 65 are individuals who pay attention. They care about their health. They care about cost. And from the policymaker standpoint, they vote. And they vote strongly. And they vote smartly. And therefore, our political figures do pay a lot of attention to who elects them and thus continues to address Medicare. And we can talk a little bit in a few minutes when we get to Medicaid, but that Medicaid population, at least as a percentage of the people served, do not vote quite as much, and therefore becomes increasingly important for other people to give voice to that Medicaid population coming forward.
Just to add again to Senator Frist's point about Medicare, while we have a lot of heated discussion about the Affordable Care Act, at Kaiser we do a lot of polling and follow the politics of healthcare very closely, there's actually some debate about whether health reform has ever really been a significant voting issue. That is, whether it's moved votes in any significant way, but there's no debate about Medicare. Medicare is healthcare's voting issue. Because seniors do come out and vote, and they vote in midterm elections, which depend on more slivers of the electorate who come out to vote in midterm elections, not just in presidential election years. So there really is no question about the political importance of the Medicare program. Another point that Senator Frist made, which I think is really important, a long time ago when I was very young, my first government job was working in what was then called HCFA, now CMS, and they handed me the assignment of figuring out whether Medicare should pay for heart transplants, which were then being done at Stanford, where Senator Frist actually also did transplant surgery. And anyway, we fumbled our way to a policy, but the point he made, which I think is really important, which we discuss in some length in the paper, is how much these programs have changed over the years. We actually have a graphic in the paper chronicling the changes in the history of the programs over the years. And I think that point also is relevant to the current heated discussion about the Affordable Care Act, because if you think about the changes which have occurred, the profound changes in Medicare and Medicaid over the years, which the senator talked about, and you fast forward and try to imagine an Affordable Care Act 50 years from now. Now, some would like to see a world without an Affordable Care Act 50 years from now, but I think it will be there in some form. You would want to think about an Affordable Care Act which looks as different from the ACA today, perhaps, as Medicare and Medicaid look from the laws that were passed in the mid-60s.
Let's continue our discussion of Medicaid. We've seen a lot of change lately in Medicaid, particularly related to expansion in the context of the Affordable Care Act. Dr. Altman, can you review some of the key challenges surrounding Medicaid for each of these stakeholder groups? As a practicing physician, I'm especially interested in your thoughts on access to care for my patients who rely on Medicaid and the difficulties of finding providers who will accept Medicaid.
Well, the funny thing about Medicaid, Medicaid is a program who everyone who's in the health care game and the health policy business game finds some reason not to like. Providers are disgruntled because of payment rates and other issues, and healthcare advocates because the program varies so much around the country and they would like it to do more. And I've been a state human services commissioner. I've actually run a Medicaid program because of the ever-increasing chunk it takes out of your budget, and liberals and conservatives fight like dogs over what the program should look like in the future. Should it remain an entitlement or be a block grant program? And so, you know, this is the program everyone on the inside finds some reason to be frustrated with or just flat out not to like. The story is very different when you talk to the American people or to people on the program. It's actually quite a popular program, not quite as popular as Social Security and Medicare, to be sure, but up there, pretty close. And beneficiaries on the program are very satisfied with the program. It's actually no longer even close to the small program for women and children on welfare it started as. It now touches more than half of the American people who've either been on the program, had a family member on the program, or a friend they know well on the program. So it has a broad reach into American society. And most people say who've been touched by the program that they're happy with their experience. The one issue they do cite is problems with access to care. Approximately one in five Medicaid beneficiaries say they've had problems getting access to a physician. So that remains the toughest Medicaid issue. It's partly explained by, but not entirely explained by, the low payment rates for providers in some states.
Let me jump in a little bit on that, because I think if we look at Medicaid, the most significant issue facing Medicaid, looking at both the recipient, the patient, as well as the provider standpoint, is this whole issue of access to care. The majority of doctors, or the, say, primary care providers, 67%, two-thirds, say and report in survey after survey that they are accepting new Medicaid patients, but also repeatedly one out of three primary care, these are frontline people, do not accept Medicaid patients. And then if you look at the specialists, fewer specialists, the trends are very negative, largely due to the relatively low reimbursement rates, accept Medicaid patients at all. That being the case, we can pass as much Medicaid legislation as we want to, and we can say we're covering people, but if there are no doctors there or nurses there to deliver the care, the coverage itself means nothing. We need to stress health and not just health care access, but actual delivery of that health care. And particular areas of concern that I saw both in my practice and as I interact constantly with physicians around the country are areas of extreme low participation of psychiatrists, of substance abuse treatment professionals. And those are important because we increasingly understand that is the behavioral aspects of medicine that in truth drive most of the burden of disease in this country. Coverage of and access to dental services is another huge problem in Medicaid that applies really for both adults and children. Put my policy hat on there for 2013 and 2014, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, we call it the Affordable Care Act, provided the federal financing to raise those Medicaid fees for most primary care physician services up to about Medicare levels. And as a result, Medicaid fees for those services rose by an average of 73% during that period. But in 2015, as those funds were withdrawn, most states have rolled back fees to the pre-Affordable Care Act levels. Access is a huge issue that has to be addressed by the policymakers because the reality is with super low reimbursement, there is no way that the provider community of doctors and nurses can responsibly, in a sustainable way, accept these patients.
And in the paper, we do present the data on the problems in particular with access to care under Medicaid for substance abuse, mental health, behavioral health services, which Senator Frist talked about. And as we think about the debate that's occurring, the big Medicaid debate that's occurring about whether or not several red states will choose to expand Medicaid coverage under the ACA, we have to think about this access issue and those particular access problems the senator's talking about.
Thanks for those great comments. Dr. Altman, do you have any predictions on whether we might see more expansion of Medicaid in the coming years?
Oh, I think we will, but I think it will be incremental. Every one of these discussions in the non-expansion states is a different discussion. I just returned from Alaska, where they're having their own discussion between an independent governor who has made Medicaid expansion his top priority and a conservative legislature that does not want to expand. And, you know, these discussions are argued on the merits, lots of numbers, lots of arguments, but they're also about state politics and relationships between governors and particular legislators. So each state story, you've heard one state story, you've heard one state story.
And just to remind our listeners, Affordable Care Act changed all the Medicaid by establishing the eligibility for non-elderly adults by setting this uniform national minimum standard eligibility at 138% of the federal poverty level. The Medicaid expansion was intended to be national, but the Supreme Court came in 3 years ago in June of 2012 and made it optional. And thus, 29 states and the District of Columbia have adopted expansion. Six states are considering it, and 16 states have opted out. And there's a whole move now with Medicaid expansion waivers being considered. But the net effect is there are about 3.7 million adults in what we in the paper call and usually call the coverage gap, meaning that they don't qualify for Medicaid, nor do they meet income requirements to qualify for the tax credits to purchase. So it is a real issue. But I think after these next elections, there's probably going to be a settling down, now 5 years into the Affordable Care Act, a settling down where some of the partisan sharp barbs, political impediments, there's a general feeling that they're going to dissipate over time, which will lead to greater expansion.
I'd like to move on now to discuss some of the future challenges confronting growth programs. In your article, you raised several issues about privatization, cost sharing, and the biggest question you ask is whether these programs should remain entitlements. And we touched on this a little earlier in the interview. So should these programs stay a guaranteed set of benefits, or should they be transformed into a different model? I'd like to hear from each of you, beginning with Senator Frist.
If you define an entitlement, once you meet that definition, you give a defined benefit of services or package. I think there will not be any diminution in the entitlement, in either the numbers in the entitlement programs or in the amount of spending, neither one. I do think, and we can start dissecting a little bit as we look at potential reforms that are for both Medicare and Medicaid. The first reform that will usually come to the forefront in Medicaid is a move towards a block grant Medicaid. So it still would be defined as an entitlement, but how that money is delivered. And a lot of the Republican budgets proposed in the House and in the Senate, and again, I'm putting my policy hat on, this year, again, call for Medicaid block grants that would fundamentally alter the financing structure of the program from a sort of formal entitlement with guaranteed matching dollars to a block grant with a predetermined amount allocated for each state type program. That would be a major change because it would ask states to take on a greater amount of the risk. The other big change, and we mentioned in the paper, are the private insurance using waivers. A lot of states now are testing a private insurance alternative through federal waivers. So the block grant Medicaid, number one, and the private insurance using waivers are the two areas of Medicaid reform that begin to encroach upon the traditional concept of entitlement.
Dr. Altman, any additional comments?
Well, I'd echo everything Senator Frist said. I guess I don't take a position on the various reform ideas. I would advise readers and listeners in this way. You know, this debate tends to break down along liberal and conservative lines, where liberals are for maintaining the entitlement and the guaranteed benefit, and conservatives are for capping the entitlement or the financial risk in some way and for privatization. And so my advice is it's not that simple. So a premium support proposal, they're not all the same. They're very different, and the details matter. And the same, at least theoretically, is true for Medicaid block grant proposals. So a Medicaid block grant proposal could give states flexibility and dramatically cut the funding to states, or it might not do that. But in the future, they will continue to be made to look at the details of the proposals so that our responses to ideas for change just don't break down along partisan lines as they have in the past.
I think adding to what Drew has said, and again, all our listeners know this, but one of the real beauties in our seemingly chaotic healthcare system is this evolution of Medicare, a federal program, and Medicaid, a joint federal-state program, where Medicaid at the state level becomes the real laboratory for reform with much more flexibility. We really see states all over America innovating and creating, and that's what's beautiful about it, because nobody has the answer today, and we do need to come together as Americans to answer these fundamental questions like the access issue in Medicaid, this whole issue of ensuring access to Medicaid providers and addressing all the distortions and all of the cost shifting caused by Medicaid pricing will require a market-based reimbursement for Medicaid providers, or they just can't participate. And there's a federal government role to ensure that. And then a second issue is increasingly we realize the social determinants of health care demand attention in order to better control program cost and address all these complex needs of the Medicaid population. Policymakers are beginning to look at and support incentives to address these social determinants of health. And they do it through bundling and capitated payments and coordinated care delivery models and integrating social supports into the reimbursement formulas. And I'll just say one last one that we'll probably see in states over the next 5 years are some of the shared savings models that are being experimented with with some pretty interesting findings, not so much in the Medicaid population, but more in what the Affordable Care Act has set up and allows.
I would just add to Senator Frist's point about social determinants of health. You certainly, through insurance expansion, can deal with people's economic security. And I wouldn't shortchange that as a goal, because when people have health insurance coverage, it helps them put food on the table and buy clothes and pay the rent and the mortgage. These are really fundamental things. But unless you also deal with issues like substance abuse and mental health problems, really jobs, the deeper issues, you can't fundamentally influence their health outcomes. So it isn't as simple as just focusing on health insurance or the expansion of health insurance coverage. Another point that we did make in the paper about these bigger reform ideas for the future is that the discussion of the choice between public and private is somewhat out of whack with the actual reality today. So that if you look at both Medicare and Medicaid, they are substantially privatized already. A third of the Medicare population are in the private Medicare Advantage plans. More than half of all state Medicaid programs are using private Medicare managed care plans. So the policy debate tends to be framed as a choice between public and private, but on the ground, when you look at the programs themselves, they are already a mixture of public and private approaches.
So you close your article with some interesting comments on the growing role of Medicare and Medicaid in shaping and reshaping the actual delivery of health care, and how these programs are encouraging, or rather almost forcing, innovation and reform. Can each of you share some final thoughts on how Medicare and Medicaid might encourage even more innovation in the coming years, and what some of those changes might be?
It is incredible, and the private sector, really the non-government sector, realizes that the size of Medicare and Medicaid encourages addressing the big problems of cost and the access issues we talked about, and to a certain extent quality, innovation, and experimentation, since we're not doing very well today compared to other countries or compared to where we know we need to be. I think that from a policy standpoint, we're likely to see reforms recognizing the size of Medicare and Medicaid being so large, so much money, that the one thing they can do easily is better coordinate their purchasing power and payment reform efforts. Together, Medicare and Medicaid have over $1 trillion of purchasing power. And right now, the power of, or the effect of the levering of that purchasing power is just not being realized. So I think that'd be number one. Number two, I think the area of Medicare Advantage, which we haven't talked very much about today, there's a general move in using Medicare Advantage, which gives more flexibility than the traditional fee-for-service model, will likely increase over time. The payment models that incentivize the delivery of high-quality, coordinated care through capitated program arrangements like that of Medicare Advantage, I think that major trend of shifting away from fee-for-service to capitated models allows and will have a lot of innovation that will come out of Medicare and, to a certain extent, Medicaid. Policymakers are right now in D.C. and in state capitals are considering how to increase provider accountability and risk through the accountable care organizations. Demonstration programs are being set up to test global capitation models. We see bundling coming forward, and all of the payment mechanisms that are being incentivized today by government. Secretary Burwell really did a kind of led on this in the sense of making a statement this year and setting very specific goals as to how much we will have in terms of reimbursement dollars and percentage of health care delivered, specific goals in 2015 and 2016 in quality-based, value-based reimbursement. That's the first time that's ever been done in history. That's the big trend where most of the policy will center how to accelerate a move from fee-for-service to value-based care. The value equation, just to remind everybody, it looks at outcomes and quality as well as dollar invested.
Dr. Altman, your thoughts?
I'll just take what Senator Frist said and put it in kind of a final historical perspective since we're writing at the 50th anniversary of the two programs. When I left MIT years ago and went to what was then the Healthcare Financing Administration, the agency had just been formed, bringing together a bunch of previously disparate agencies and bringing together Medicare and Medicaid for the first time. And it actually had a vision, and the vision had to do with purchasing power and using the power of and the leverage of those two giant programs to drive change and reform and progress throughout the healthcare system. Over the years, for a bunch of reasons, that vision lapsed, and the agency and the programs became essentially public bill payers and insurance companies, and they were not also terribly coordinated. That is, Medicare was in one place and Medicaid was in another, and they didn't talk to each other terribly well. Now, in effect, they are moving back to the beginning with a broader vision of using their purchasing power to drive change and innovation and payment with the right incentives, which the senator talked about, throughout the healthcare system. I think we can have debates about ACOs versus bundling and everything else, but it is to use payment to move the incentives in a better direction. And that's a welcome development in an historical context. It's a bigger vision for Medicare and for Medicaid, and for the first time, for Medicare and Medicaid working together more than they have in the past. And for me, it's a little bit of back to the beginning, because that's how it all started.
Thank you, Dr. Altman and Senator Frist, for joining us today. This is Preeti Malani on behalf of the entire editorial team at JAMA. For more author interviews, please visit us online at JAMA.com. You can also subscribe to these podcasts on iTunes and Stitcher.